Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm B.B. Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, the author of the forthcoming novel Brotherless Night.
Forthcoming in 2 days! From today when we're recording, I guess. This episode will be out. It'll already be out.
Yeah. And by the time this episode airs, it will actually be out, which feels, at least to me, like an elaborate hoax.
Well, I don't know how to respond to that. What? Who would be the hoaxer in this case? You wrote the book. It's great. It's on the New York Times list of books to read for January 2023. It just got a great review in the Times. I forgot to mention that this, in the last episode, when I was trying to convince you of good things that happened in 2022 and you were shutting me down, can't you admit that you finishing this book is a good thing that happened in 2022?
It's true. I did finish the book, and I'm willing to admit that this is a good thing, but I'm also willing to admit that I did it with some help from a lot of people, including you. You read a draft and you gave me notes, and many, many others who did the same.
And today we're going to talk about your new novel, Brotherless Night, but we're also going to talk about that often undiscussed part of finishing a novel. We've done episodes before about how editors, agents, and publicists contribute to the publishing of a book, but we haven't talked much about a resource that has often been important to me and I know is important to many writers.
That's right, the Friend Network, the writers you can turn to for honest and usually unpaid input about the book you were working on.
Very cheap.
Friends like that are incredibly important to me and to so many other writers, and today I get to talk to two of my writer friends about my book, the first being you.
And the second being novelist Curtis Sittenfeld. Curtis is the best-selling author of 6 novels, Prep, The Man of My Dreams, American Wife, Sisterland, Eligible, and Rodham. Her first story collection, You Think It, I'll Say It, was published in 2018 and picked for Reese Witherspoon's book club. Her books have been selected by the New York Times, Time, Entertainment Weekly, and People for their 10 Best Books of the Year lists. Option for film and television, translated into 30 languages. Her short stories have appeared in The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Esquire, and in Best American Short Stories, of which she was the 2020 guest editor. Her nonfiction has appeared in The New York Times, Time, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, Slate, and On This American Life. A graduate of Stanford University and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Curtis has appeared as a guest on NPR's Fresh Air, CBS's The Early Show, and PBS NewsHour, and 4 times been a Jeopardy answer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Whitney, and thank you, Sugi. It's such a delight to be here.
And her new novel, Romantic Comedy, which I just finished reading an advanced copy of and which is fan-fucking-tastic, will be out in April. Curtis, welcome back to the show.
All right, so from here on out, Curtis and I are taking over the host responsibilities, and we are moving you, Sugi, into the guest position. So everyone, the listeners can just do that in their minds, which means that our questions get to be written out and yours have to be made up. My first question is this. Sugi, what is the book Emergency 58, which is referenced early on in your new novel, Brotherless Night? And can you please read a short passage from the book referencing that novel and talk about the political and historical setting of your book?
Sure. So Emergency 58 is actually not a novel, and I have a copy of it here. It is a very old nonfiction book, and it's a work of journalism that was written by someone who was the editor of the Salon Observer, and it's an account of the 1958 race riots in Sri Lanka. It's an extremely brutal read. And I got a copy of it somewhere like on eBay when I was at the workshop, and just found it to be full of information that I didn't know and a lot of primary sources. So it's a book that a lot of people who are Sri Lankan and particularly Tamil know about. So I should explain also what that means. So My novel, Brotherless Night, is set primarily in northern Sri Lanka and is about a Tamil family. That means they're from the ethnic Tamil minority. And they live in Jaffna, which is a Tamil-dominated town in northern Sri Lanka. And they're sort of living through a period of time. The novel starts in 1981, where Tamil militant groups are starting to form and where there's starting to be some violent resistance to the Sri Lankan government, which over kind of successive administrations, different parties, kind of since Sri Lankan independence has been involved in state-sponsored discrimination and violence against ethnic minorities and specifically Tamil people. So the 1958 riots are one example of that. And so this book...
So people are using that book as a way to look back at what might be coming.
Yeah. And the person who wrote this, actually, if I'm remembering correctly, I think his children are novelists and maybe journalists. And he emigrated, as I recall, like this book was censored. Like it wasn't, I don't think it was freely available all over the place. It was also a little bit contraband. Like it wasn't supposed to be published or read. And yet it certainly was. The fact that I was able in like 2004 or five to get a hold of it. And then later I realized that was a massive stroke of luck. And because in years since when I've tried to find a copy, it's been sort of difficult. So in Brotherless Night, my book, the family in question has a copy and it's sort of getting passed around. The siblings, except for some of them, are maybe not ready to read it. So I'll read a little bit from that section. And this is from the point of view of the protagonist, Sashi, who is a 16-year-old girl. At 16, I still hadn't touched Emergency 58, but I knew it was a brutal testimony to Sri Lanka's willingness to slaughter its own Tamil citizens. My father's slim, battered copy of the book had taken on the aura of something forbidden and terrifying. Did I need to read it to know that because we were ethnic minorities, Tamils were considered expendable? I didn't know how old one needed to be to read the whole of a violent story. I didn't know if the whole of any violent story could be told. I did faithfully read the newspapers, which quoted Tamil political leaders saying that any move for a separate homeland in the northern part of the country would not be violent. The party my father supported had adopted a resolution saying exactly that the previous year. Tamils would work for a separate state in the north and east of the country peacefully, like the Gandhians, whom we admired. But we could no longer bear the discrimination of a government dominated by the majority Sinhalese, the Tamil politicians declared. No more second-class status for our language, double standards and quotas for Tamil students, government-run Sinhala colonization schemes in traditionally Tamil areas, no more government-fomented anti-Tamil violence. The 1958 riots had taken place 10 years after the British left, and the riots of my childhood, well into the years of independence, had also been vicious. But I knew that when Appa listened to Tamil politicians argue about the right path to self-determination, their incompetence and inconsistency worried him. When he went to postings in other parts of the country, he kept his own counsel, but at home he often vented his feelings to my brothers, Niranjan, Thailand, or to my mother. These fellows would say anything to help themselves, he said darkly. I was never sure whether my mother was listening to him or not. She silently went on with her daily tasks, chopping vegetables, washing dishes, and sweeping up the cigarette ash he dropped as he pounded his fists. Other empires had reached for Sri Lanka. The Dutch, the Portuguese, and the British had seized and relinquished it in succession, leaving in their wake peoples divided by colonial powers, ancestral angers, and bullheaded pride. Long before I was born, Sri Lanka, then Ceylon, stumbled once more into a lazy, self-indulgent independence. The majority Sinhalese, smarting at sights, slights, perceived and actual, discovered ways for the country to promote their Buddha, their language, and their histories, a comeuppance for us, for Tamils, who were a minority and who had flourished in English. Learn Sinhalese or leave your job, Tamil civil servants were told, my father among them. I still haven't forgotten the look on his face when he told us.
Thank you so much, Sugi. I love Brotherless Night so much. It's such a pleasure to hear you read it aloud, and it's so exciting that it's coming out into the world. So the book basically starts in the early 80s, and, you know, sort of follows the early years of the Civil War. And I know that your family is from Sri Lanka. You are from Maryland. So I'm curious, I mean, one, do you perhaps want to say what year you were born, and what was your awareness of the conflict growing up, or just your general awareness of Sri Lanka?
Sure. And thank you so much for all of your generous support of the book, which has been so extraordinary, and which has changed the book in ways that I think we're going to talk about later. I was born in 1980, so just a shade before this book's action kicks off. The narrator is older than me, and she's 16 in 1981 when the book starts. And I think, you know, I grew up kind of on stories of Sri Lanka and on news coverage, sometimes on the kind of propaganda that circulated in the Tamil diaspora, which was largely coming out of Tamil militant groups. Or out of cultural organizations that were sympathetic to Tamil nationalism, of which there are many, many different strands. And so I think I grew up with a strong sense of the Sri Lankan state as an unjust entity. And I think probably one of my earliest memories is of news coverage of the 1983 riots, which did prompt some members of my family to emigrate. And so I was aware of that as kind of a canonical incident of not just Sri Lankan history, but also of my family itself. And in Maryland, there is a sizable Tamil community, and I was connected to them through largely cultural and religious events. And at least in my experience, those were, if an organization was called like a Sri Lanka Association, it was often very Sinhala dominated or Sinhalese dominated. And Tamil organizations often had the word Tamil in them. And so organizations where people were interacting across ethnic boundaries, at least in the diaspora, were somewhat rare. And that said, I also have like a lot of mixed heritage in my own family, including cousins who come from other ethnic communities in Sri Lanka or who are of mixed heritage and who speak multiple languages. So I think that my family had kind of porous borders, but I was involved in some aspects of the community where like the lines were really severe.
So I just wanted to give listeners a sense of the dramatis personae here. I've given myself this question so that you can correct me on all of my pronunciations, which I'm sure I'm going to jack up. But because I've been reading the book, but I haven't been listening to you read it aloud. So the narrator is Sashikala. Is that the right way to say that?
Yeah, Sashikala.
Sashikala, also known as Sashi. Oh, it sounds a lot like somebody else's nickname. I don't know.
Isn't it like against the law for fiction writers to do this to each other? Like this is what non-fiction writers
do. I do
like,
want to say that you...
Clearly the protagonist is a stand-in for you. Have you always written totally autobiographically or just with this book? Sorry, carry on. Are you guys going to keep me as your...
Well, I was going to say that her nickname is Kunju also. Someone calls her that in the course of the book, and that is the name of your dog, Sugi. I don't know what that's all about, but fine. I just know that you like your dog. All right, so she grows up in Jaffna, which is a Tamil-dominated city in Sri Lanka's northern province. She's studying science and hopes to be a doctor. She has four brothers, thus the title of the novel. Ceylan, Dayalan, Niranjan, and Aran.
Ceylan, Dayalan, Niranjan, and Aran.
Okay, Ceylan, Dayalan, Niranjan, and Aran. A frenemy, or at least that's how I sort of think of this character, named Kay, who also wants to be a doctor and grows up in her neighborhood. Does that seem like a fair summary?
Yeah, that's a great summary. I will just note that the word Kunju in Tamil basically means sweetie or darling. As regular listeners to this show know, my schnoodle is very dear to my heart, and that is her name. I have also regularly in my life been called Kunju by various older relatives.
I see. So you name your dog for yourself. Okay, well, moving on.
Anyway, that is a fair summary. She grows up with four brothers. She is the second to last in the birth order, so only Aaron is younger than her. And she has her mother, Amma, who lives in the house with her, and her father, who kind of works in a civil service kind of job where he is posted what would be called outstation. So he travels to different locations, and he's home sort of sporadically in a way that is sometimes helpful and sometimes disruptive. And so he's kind of absent present.
Sugi, I want to ask you a little bit about how you created a sense of place in the book. So much of the story takes place in Jaffna. And I think my sort of two-part question is, one, what makes that a specific area within Sri Lanka, or, you know, different from what kind of gives it its identity? And how much research did you do, or have you been there?
Sure. Thanks for that question. So Jaffna, my family has history in Jaffna. And I guess, yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of family in Jaffna over the years. I have been there. Obviously, I wasn't there during the time that the events of this book take place. It is kind of an unofficial Tamil capital of Sri Lanka in many ways. And it has, for example, a very large Hindu temple, and certain sort of cultural locations that are just significant in Sri Lankan Tamil life. It's also sort of famously a place that is that has a long history of kind of casteism, which is something that the book touches on a little bit. And it's a place that can be it's famously interested in education, in some ways famously socially conservative. And yet it also gave rise to really interesting political dissidents, people who I was really interested in. So that sort of seeming incongruity was something that I was drawn to. And it is, yeah, it's a place that, because of my family's connection to it, I do feel strongly about it. And I think that a lot of Sri Lankan fiction has been set in the capital of Sri Lanka, which is Colombo. And I also have family connections in Colombo, but it was important to me to set a novel specifically in Jaffna, which has been done. It's not like it's unprecedented, but it's not as common. And I wanted to center and also critique and think sort of self-critique, think about ideas of Tamilness that have come out of Jaffna, which I think gave rise to both Tamil militancy and people who felt themselves able to critique the state and Tamil militancy. And it's a really beautiful place. And it's a place that during the war was impacted by a lot of violence, a lot of shelling, displacements. And so as a place that is, like, in many Tamil people's heads, like, really very strongly home, it is also the site of repeated displacements. And so
what would you say makes it, sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what would you say makes it beautiful? Like, what are the sort of what's the notable beauty of it?
It has some beautiful beaches. I remember after the war was over, there was some media coverage that was kind of like, oh, and now these beaches, which are unspoiled, are accessible to everyone. And I was like, this is horrible. Just the sort of exoticizing coverage of it. Sort of, I think that sometimes people think of Jaffna as other kind of within Sri Lanka. And I, of course, do not think of it as other. So kind of making that particular beauty normal. It has a lot of beautiful plant life that's very particular to that region. So the palmyra tree is a symbol of Jaffna. And also just a lot of really beautiful buildings, like one of the most beautiful temples I've ever seen, which is the Nellar Kandasamy Temple, which is where some of the scenes are set.
So this novel, as we've been talking about, thank you for that's a really good answer. Those are things I didn't know about you, and I've known you for a long time. Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back. So, you know, this book is a wide historical novel. It's covering an important historical era. It's like writing a novel about the American Civil War, really, in its breadth. But although it's very personal, right, and told all from Sashi's point of view. So I wanted you to talk about how you did research about such an important historical period with all kinds of events that are happening. You wrote an essay for LitHub about your research, and we'll link to it in our show notes. And I'm also asking this to sort of avoid spoilers in the plot. We're not going to tell people what happens in the book toward the end, especially. But can you talk to our listeners about the research you did and how the imaginary world you built relates to what actually happened in fact? And how did you pick which real events to include? Like, there's the burning of this library in Jaffna is a big important event in the novel. I'm assuming that that's real, but I don't know that for a fact.
Sure. Thanks for that question. Yeah. The Jaffna Public Library did burn in 1981. That's one of the historical events that begins the novel. And that incident was also in Love Marriage. So apparently I would like to write about it repeatedly. And so that's an example of a real incident. There are a fair number of historically accurate things in the book, some of them very obvious and others less so. The 1983 Black July riots are in the book. And let's see, there are some deaths of historical figures, which are also represented in the book.
Like Indira Gandhi.
Yes, like Indira Gandhi's death is in the book. And I think it's hard work to write about historical events that a lot of people know about. And at least in my community, these events are really well known. They're also not actually separate from our lives. I think that there's like a little bit of a danger of kind of like writing, I don't know, Sri Lankan Forrest Gump, like, oh, I happen to be here, and then I happen to be here, and then I happen to be here. And I kind of thought about that. I was like, huh, what a coincidence. And then I realized that sort of as I did research, it became very evident to me that that sort of thing was actually the case for a lot of ordinary people. That I remember talking to someone who was an expert about two particular violent incidents in which young Tamil people were killed. And I learned that in one family, these were both really well-known incidents. There were families where, for example, like one child might have been impacted by one incident and another child might have been impacted by the other. And that actually wasn't implausible. And that people I knew had been impacted by the 1983 riots, had been displaced. Like, I had grown up on stories of that. And then I also have friends who are my age who were impacted by those riots and who were very generous in speaking with me about them. And it just became really clear that, I don't know, like, where was I when Obama was elected? I was alone in an apartment in Saratoga Springs. Like, wasn't hugely dramatic. I don't know. Like, so history didn't intersect with my life in as powerful a way. But like, Sri Lanka is actually a very small country, and almost everyone's lives were impacted by the war in some way. And so history wasn't really distant. So I think I erred on the side of including things. And I read a lot of books to do that. And then I also just spoke to a lot of people who were really generous with their time and experiences and who encouraged me to write about them. Because even as these experiences are, like I said, well-known in our community, I think there was a desire both on my part and often on the parts of the people I spoke to for it to be set down in a kind of record.
Sugi, I have a question about sort of your readers or anticipated or imagined readers. Do you feel like, so I wrote a kind of political-ish novel, and I feel like if somebody who's covered, a reporter who's covered presidential campaigns says like, oh, I love the scene with, you know, that is about the political reporters, I feel like a particular pride or satisfaction. Do you feel like there are readers that this book is most for, or, you know, or who you feel most worried about their read of it, or, you know, like either it's most for them emotionally or factually, or just in terms of when you were thinking of, I mean, you obviously held yourself to a very high standard while writing, and like, was it partly on this type of reader's behalf?
That's a great question. I think maybe a good example. A lot of the readers I think I was worried about, or who I imagined, whose opinions I cared about the most, I tried to actually just reach out to, or were people who were involved in helping me research things, or who helped me to figure out how to get things right. And also, a lot of those people were people who had a lot of understanding and generosity about the ways in which a fiction writer might take creative license.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, that was an enormous, that was a huge amount of grace to have going into research, that those people would spend that kind of time with me and also sort of say, oh, and I see this place where you diverged. And that's like, I see that that's interesting.
So you would potentially you'd interview someone and then you'd show them what you had written and they would give you feedback.
Sometimes, like, a lot of people read drafts. A lot of people. When I was writing my acknowledgments, I was like, oh my God, what a scary list.
When I was reading your acknowledgments, I was like, oh my God. I was like, I don't think I know that many people.
I mean, and then also, and I think, you know, you...
Well, let's talk about that list of acknowledgments, because the peg for this episode is the friends that you've had, is the idea that every writer, not just you, has friends who are other writers usually, but sometimes also people who are expert in some field. I mean, I remember having, I had female soldiers read The Good Lieutenant because that was an audience, as Curtis was saying, that I was worried about and wanted to make sure that I could get feedback on from them. So, you know, but there's a particular read that you get from a fellow writer who's a professional at whatever you're doing, and they're going to talk to you about it. And so I know that Curtis read the book, and gave you notes. So I wanted to know how her read affected the final draft of the book, and what advice did you take, and what advice did you reject wholeheartedly? But be polite about.
Always polite.
I think so. In anticipation of this conversation, I did go and look up Curtis's notes.
That seems like a good use of your time, Siggy.
And then I was like, oh my God, what did I? Did I take everything? Like, did I forget anything? Because I think that often, and this was true of me when I was in workshops as well, I kind of have let my memory sift things because I'm aware that I have a kind of anxiety that is like, I want to dot every I and cross every T. And I have a pretty good memory. So I think, like, if I'm absolutely sure that I want to do something and I'm really freaked out that I'll forget about it, I will write it down. But also, I'm allowing things to accumulate by way of, like, what did you say that this other person also said? So to give you an example, like, there is the father character in the book. Curtis had observed that she felt like he kind of vanished after a certain page. And then a couple of other people had also said that. And I was like, including Whitney, I think maybe you also said that. And I was like, that's totally accurate. A couple of other people had kind of given me emotional notes about the family and the ways that families behaved during this time period with each other when they were under this pressure. And so I think when I'm revising, I'm also often trying to allow my subconscious to come up with answers that are one answer to multiple problems. So then like, the father now appears more, and he also does that in ways that hit the emotional beats. I'm trying to do this to avoid spoilers. Hit the emotional beats that those people were looking for.
Well, I think I want to be more specific. He has a very confrontational scene with Sashi where she sort of stands up for herself and for what she's doing and says, you've been absent. You haven't been here. I don't care what you had to say. And one of the things that we talked about was, like, I remember saying, like, give her as much agency as you possibly can, right? So that scene also, like, does a whole bunch of different stuff. It brings the father back. It helped clarify for me, like, what everyone's political positions were in the family, because that's what they're arguing about, what her brothers are doing, what political side they're on, what political side she's on. And then she's also being very direct with him. I just thought that was a great addition to the book.
Go ahead, Sugi.
No, go ahead.
No, you're the host, so we get to interrupt. That's part of being the host. The guest has to allow the
interruption. I like to interrupt when I'm a guest or a host. It just feels so right. Now, well, I was going to say, I think that there is, I mean, I really agree with what I think you're saying, which is, like, if you get a bunch of feedback on how to revise, I really think it's smart for a writer, or at least for me, to go kind of one major revision point at a time, because it's like one revision can actually like redistribute the weight of the whole novel, or it can have this kind of cascading effect. And so then there's things that like you end up automatically cutting that you wouldn't have thought you'd cut, or like, as you're saying, like you've kind of killed two birds with one stone and you don't have to address something that you thought you actively had to address. So I feel like that's very familiar to me. I wanted to ask, I know you started this novel in 2004, which is kind of mind blowing. And I also just want to say, I think that like, it's possible if I could have read a novel that someone had started in 2004 and been like, wonder what that person's been up to all this time. But this feels like just like such a meticulous, you know, but like a live novel. And just, it feels kind of like, okay, I know what you were doing. This is like epic. It's so smart. There's so many things that like work so beautifully and are so affecting. And, but also that it is kind of wild that, you know, it's like 2023. What has it been like to work on a novel for close to, you know, 20 years? Has it been sort of your companion? Has it been frustrating? Like your life has changed. The world has changed. What will you do now? This is like 7 questions. This might be too many. This might be its own episode. But like, yeah, like what's it like to work on a novel for close to 20 years? And does it feel amazing or terrifying for it to be out in the world?
Thanks.
you can just say yes.
Thank you for all of those generous comments. Yes. It is terrifying, and I think also a little bit surreal. Yeah, so I guess I was 24 when I started this novel, and now I'm 42. And I don't know, I feel, again, sort of thinking back to being an MFA student, that there's a lot of kind of, you know, it takes the time it takes. And then also, I think really smart and specific advice, like I remember Elizabeth McCracken sort of saying, finish your book within a time that you're like the same person. Because if you take a really long time, you'll be like 7 different people while you're working on one book. And that, I think, did happen to me. I was several different Sugis while I worked on the book. And I think all of them made their way in there, but that wasn't, reconciling them to one narrative wasn't always the easiest thing. Was it my companion? I think, like, it shifted over the years, right? I think in the early years, my first 2 books had been sold together. And in the early years of something like that happening, there's always the kind of flush of excitement, and like people who aren't in the literary world think like the phrase 2-book deal is very exciting. And of course, I think people in the literary world also think that is very exciting. But it's also a lot of pressure on a young writer. And I think like I frankly, like at the time that I sold those 2 books, I think needed the money, and also they were acquired by an editor I knew and trusted immensely, my friend Rebecca Shapiro, who's no longer in publishing. And Becca was the only editor who knew that I had a second novel. So she's also the only person who bid on it. She kind of made a move to win my first novel by saying, I know that you've got this other one and I want that one too. And that was hugely fortunate. And then I think also just kind of a lot of pressure to have a book out in the world and sort of be like, you got to turn this other one in too. You know, like 3 people kind of knew that the second one was differently ambitious, stylistically different. And I had to teach myself how to write it over a longer period of time than I did Love Marriage, and with less formal help, like a lot of help that I constructed myself. And then there was definitely, I think, a period of time in there where there were like probably a lot of people, I would sort of walk around and be like, I would sort of start to know that there were some people who thought I wasn't going to finish. And that's like an interesting feeling, because then you sort of have to believe you're going to finish. And then the people who did believe I was going to finish became rarer and rarer and more precious to me. And I think that was really like a kind of, because like, I think some people also saw really bad drafts, and including Becca, like things where I was like, this should not be finished because it's really terrible. And like there was like a snappy version where there was a lot more stuff in New York, and there was like a young reporter who would sort of walk around carrying a yoga mat on her back. And, you know, she got like brutally slashed because she didn't belong in this book. I mean, she must belong in like some like Sex in the City featuring young Sri Lankans that I'm not aware of. That
doesn't. Oh my God, please mean. Write that. In addition to, not instead of. I would read that.
So I did work in this novel a really long time, has had at least 4 or 5 titles. And back when I sent you both the novel and you both had the same version, it was Movement, version number 5, which was probably more like draft number 20. And it's sometimes hard for me to see how the book has changed over time. I think that's sort of one of the things buried in the answer I was rambling through just before. But I was so close to it for so long, I made incremental changes, which to other people sometimes seem like really big changes, and they're invisible to me. So, of course, you now both have these finished copies, and I'm curious about how you perceive the differences between what you read in 2020, kind of late in the novel's aging process, and this finished version.
All right. Well, I'm going to pick up on this, which is because I just read, you know, the new version of the book, or at least most of it, over the last few days. And one of the things that I thought it had to do with a comment that I remember making to you, and I don't know if Curtis made this comment as well or other readers did, where I basically was like a couple things like, what is the narrator's ethical position? Because really, Sashi's caught between the Thamel tigers who like are on her family's ethnicity, but also like doing things that she disapproves of, right? And the Sinhalese majority who are clearly doing things that threaten her life, right? And you know, killing people in her neighborhood, right? And arresting her family. So how do you define what her want is, right? In other words, other than just being a passive recipient of bad things that are happening to her. And I thought you did a lot of things to make that clear, right? This was in the book, but you've emphasized it more, the way that her medical, you know, work begins to connect to the Tamils. I think that scene with her dad that you talk about is also really good for sort of defining her ethic. And also, I thought that you also did in between the draft that I read and this final one, you clarified for a reader who might not be, like me, super Sri Lankan politics, you made it possible to read the book and understand exactly what the differences were between the Tamils and the Sinhalese, what the disputes were over. I thought adding that Emergency 58, which I don't remember being in the original draft, was really helpful. And that passage that you read was really helpful. I don't remember that being in there. So those were the kinds of things that I noticed that I thought just made the book work. All the bones were there, but these were just smaller things that made it easier for me to see the overall story, you know, because I wasn't struggling with other peripheral issues.
Go ahead. I would never make it on a podcast with all this horrible interrupting. I'm like the worst. I was just going to say, I have a friend, a writer friend, who thinks that any reader has like one useful or helpful read in them, and then like that's it. You know, it's too familiar. And I think I believe in this theory, and like have tried to say to people, like, give me your manuscript when you most want my feedback. Because almost to Witt's point, like, I can see what's changed, but I almost feel like I've lost my ability to know if it's improved. Do you agree with that?
My editor always talks about fresh eyes. And I think, like, emotionally as a writer, I'm like, read this as many times as I need. And, you know, I'm sort of like, I need constant feedback. And of course, like, that's not a thing
that's why you need a bunch of friends exactly. to read it, and not, you can't, you, cause you'll burn out your editor or your agent after a while.
And I think that she was right. Cause right. It's the same problem that you have as the writer, your fresh eyes are gone. And right. Like the some of the passage that I read was in the original Emergency 58, you're right, wasn't there. And that was in part because of a comment from the person who actually did the audiobook, who had talked to me about the books that were in the book. And as I had that conversation with her, I sort of started putting more and more other books in the book. And that I found really helped me to respond to your comment. And then I also want to mention, because I think it's really, Curtis, I don't even know if you remember making this comment, you made like a really key suggestion about the first line of the book, which altered huge parts of the plot and the very first sentence of the book. Which before that had been fixed in place for like 15 years. And you were like, have you considered doing this, which would just give the narrator a shade more agency, which resonated with that thing that Whitney had said about giving her more agency. And then that played out over the course of the book so that everything that happened after that was different.
So you mean I recently sent a letter to a terrorist I used to know? Okay.
Wait, what was the sentence before that?
It was, I recently went to an appointment with a terrorist I used to know.
Oh.
Is that, so I don't think right. this is spoiling anything. Was the scene where Kay kind of, Sashi burns herself and Kay kind of helps her by putting raw eggs on her skin. Was that always so early on? Was it right away?
I'm trying to remember where it was in version 5. There was a version where it was slightly later.
Because I remember that scene very vividly, and then I opened it, and I thought, I mean, I'm sure I remember it partly because it's vivid, but I thought, do I remember this in part because it's the very first scene? And then I sort of, again, I mean, you know, I have a terrible memory, but...
It wasn't always the very first scene.
Congratulations, Sugi. For writing a big, beautiful book that so many people will love.
Thank you.
And Curtis, thanks for joining us to talk about
Curtis
it.
Curtis for becoming Sugi.
We're looking forward to romantic comedy, so that'll be exciting. And I'm sure you'll be getting some comments from Sugi on
Sugi,
that.
Sugi, not Curtis Sugi.
I'm signing on to Goodreads right after this.
Please.
And Sugi, thanks for being our guest today. Congratulations on the book. It is fantastic. I'm really so happy for you. You got a great review in the Times, as we mentioned at the top, and you'll deserve many more, and I hope everyone will go out and read the book. Next time, we'll go back to having you as co-host, and listeners, please, don't miss Brotherless Night. It's out now.
Thanks so much to you both. Thanks for having me.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!